This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 31st of July, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Lawmakers walk out of a briefing on reorganizing the country's intelligence community, saying the Bush administration has left them in the dark. The International Olympic Committee strikes a secret deal with Chinese authorities to block access to certain websites.
The most scandalous thing of all is that the International Olympic Committee has been aiding and abetting Chinese government censorship.
And as journalist layoffs continue around the nation, we'll hear about the struggle for media reform.
It's a political issue. When a community is able to challenge members of Congress, the FCC, that they want change in our media system, then I think you'll start seeing the other groups, the journalists, the national civil rights groups, getting more involved.
All that and more after this news.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Oil giant ExxonMobil has broken its own record for the highest profits raked in by a company in a three-month period. ExxonMobil's quarterly profits of $11.68 billion breaks down to $5.4 million an hour. Royal Dutch Shell also broke its own company record today with a quarterly profit of $11.56 billion. But some shareholders were apparently unimpressed. Many sold off their company stocks this morning after runaway prices at the pump failed to fulfill expectations for even higher returns. In other news, the House of Representatives passed the Consumer Product Safety Commission reauthorization bill yesterday. Consumer advocates say that while the bill would ban lead and phthalates from children's products, it doesn't go far enough. Africa Jones reports.
Consumer advocates say that phthalates should be banned altogether. Phthalates are used in everything from lotion to shower curtains, but many studies have linked the chemicals to diseases like cancer and asthma, and the biggest concern is their effects on the reproductive and hormonal systems. Bill Walker is vice president of the Environmental Working Group.
We're starting to see what's called cross-gender animals, an animal that's actually having changes made to their reproductive system as a result of exposure to these chemicals. And we have very good reason to be concerned about the same sort of thing happening as people are exposed to these chemicals.
Theo Colburn, president of the Integrin Production Exchange, says this week's bill doesn't go far enough.
It's a band-aid. They're not getting to the core of the problem. One out of every third child born today is going to get diabetes sometime before it dies. If you're a minority, it's one out of two. And remember, insulin is a hormone. We are damaging people before they are born so that they're doomed to a life of chronic illness and medication from the time they're born until they die.
If the law passes the Senate, which is expected this week, and the president signs the bill, the ban would take effect in 6 months. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
The Taliban has ended a short-lived ceasefire with Pakistani security forces in the region along the Afghan border by launching a fresh offensive this week and torching two girls' schools today. Rahman Ullah has more from Peshawar.
The recent clashes began when Taliban fighters killed three intelligence agents on Monday evening. The attacks were the first since Taliban commander Maulana Fazlullah last week announced the cancellation of the peace agreement signed in May. Fazlullah accused the government of not honoring the accord by failing to release all imprisoned militants, implement the Islamic judicial system, and withdraw troops from Swat. Information Minister of the Frontier Province Mia Iftikhar Hussain Shah says the Taliban violated the peace agreement and the current army operation is the reaction to the militants' offensive.
A peace agreement does not mean the Taliban have been given a free hand to torch schools, slaughter people, and run their training centers. It is a government responsibility to enforce the law and defeat those who are a threat to the people's lives, and we are justified in using power against the militants.
The Taliban kidnapped 25 members of the Pakistani security forces on Tuesday after a raid on a checkpoint. An army spokesman says 10 members of the security forces and 25 militants have died in the new operation. The Taliban claims to have lost only 5 fighters. Government officials say 9 civilians have been killed, including 7 members of a single family. Officials say the death toll could be much higher as several houses have been destroyed in the renewed fighting. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rahmanullah in Peshawar.
The Indian and Pakistani foreign affairs ministers met with each other today on the sidelines of the summit of the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation to discuss recent ceasefire violations along the line of control dividing Kashmir. Shanawaz Khan has more.
The meeting comes amidst accusations from India that Pakistan has violated the ceasefire along their line of control in Kashmir twice this week. Pakistan has denied the allegations. The Indian military said that on Monday, Pakistani troops sneaked over the line of control that divides Kashmir between the two countries and fired at its troops, killing one soldier. The two countries exchanged heavy fire for over 12 hours before agreeing to a halt on Tuesday. A day after, on Wednesday, India again complained of a ceasefire violation. Indian officials have described the peace process with Pakistan as under stress after a suicide bomb attack on its Kabul embassy in early July killed 41 people. India's PTI news agency reports that Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh is likely to meet with his Pakistani counterpart on Saturday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar.
Accused Serbian war criminal Radovan Karadzic made his first court appearance today before the International Tribunal in The Hague. Israel Rafalovich was there and files this report.
A somber and clean-shaven Karadzic appeared before Judge Alphonse Ory, telling the court that he will represent himself. The judge read a summary of the chilling indictment, which included descriptions of actions by Bosnian Serb forces led by Karadzic during the 1991-1995 war, including the killings of scores of civilians, the establishment of detention camps, and the forced deportation of thousands of non-Serbs and the wanton destruction of non-Serb property. Karadzic declined to enter a plea, and he has 30 days to do so. Under court rules, if Karadzic refuses to enter a plea, then a plea of not guilty will be entered for him. In today's hearing, Karadzic complained of numerous irregularities in his capture and subsequent transfer to court. He disputed the day of his arrest by Serbian authorities, claiming that they detained him for 3 days before acknowledging it. The judge cut Karadzic short and refused to let him read a four-page account of his grievances or to hand the document over to court. Karadzic also spoke of his fears of being assassinated in custody. Judge Ory set the next hearing date for August 29th. Israel Rafalovich, FSRN, The Hague.
The Bush administration has asked the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to keep all challenges to the recently passed FISA legislation secret. The Justice Department petition also requested that the court refuse to hear any challenges unless they originate from the DOJ. Jamil Jaffer of the American Civil Liberties Union, an organization that has filed a constitutional challenge to the new FISA law, reacted to the DOJ petition, saying, quote, "If the government's request is granted, the court won't hear arguments from anyone except the government, and those arguments will be presented to the court in secret briefs. At the end of the process, the court will issue a ruling that is also secret." The new FISA legislation gives the government sweeping powers to monitor the communications of its citizens and gives telecom companies retroactive immunity for helping the government spy on customers before it became legal. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
As President Bush touts what he calls progress in Iraq today, U.S. oil companies are also making progress in Iraq getting oil. And Dennis Kucinich, Democrat of Ohio, wants to stop it. Kucinich is introducing legislation that would prevent U.S.-based oil companies from investing in petroleum resources in Iraq. Currently, U.S. oil companies are developing technical assistance contracts there, which some say is a step towards privatization, which would leave U.S. oil companies in control and the Iraqi people shut out of the process. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Representative Dennis Kucinich of Ohio says oil companies are hungry to expand the current contracts in Iraq.
International oil companies see an opportunity. The technical service contracts are limited. The international oil companies have no rights to Iraqi oil. They simply provide contracted services for an agreed-upon price. They do offer opportunities, both today as well as the chance to get a foot in the door with regards to future Iraqi production.
Since the start of the war in Iraq, many have said that the Bush administration went into the war because of oil. In 2006, the Bush administration released a list of benchmarks of what they would consider success in Iraq. One of these is passing a hydrocarbon law by the Iraqi government. The Bush administration characterized the legislation as a national revenue sharing plan, But Kucinich says it was really an undercover way to open up the Iraq oil industry to private companies. Kucinich says all along, the State Department has been making inroads.
The attempted privatization of Iraq's oil is happening at a time when multinational oil companies are already making record profits. The United States must support the Iraqi desire to keep its own oil revenue. U.S. involvement in any attempt to privatize the petroleum resources of Iraq is immoral and should be stopped. We can do better for the Iraqi people after destroying their country, and we must.
The Iraqi Constitution says the resources of the oil company are owned by the people. But with the instability and with Congress voting on legislation that says Iraq must help with its own reconstruction efforts, many feel the time is right for oil companies to move in. By some estimates, it will take up to 10 years to bring the oil production up to speed. Speaking to the BBC, one former Iraq Prime Minister of Oil, Dr. Muhammad Bar al-Ulum, agrees.
We would like to see development and upgrading of the refineries. We would like to see some sort of upgrading in the petrochemical industry. We would like to see upgrading of all the infrastructure of the oil sector.
There is a caveat, however, that always remains.
But in the same time, we would like to see some frame of contract which preserve the interest of the Iraqi people.
Steve Kretzman from the advocacy group PriceOfOil.org says taking privatization out of the picture could make the situation more stable.
It's clear that the fact that a privatization agenda has been pushed as part of the occupation is actually, I think, makes the political climate much more dangerous, and it tends to, it really polarizes debate in a very unhelpful way in Iraq. What would be the best would be for the U.S. And U.S. oil companies to be completely hands-off about it at this point and let the Iraqis decide.
Despite the current contracts, some oil companies are still hesitant to send personnel to Iraq due to the constant instability in the country. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
The Department of the Interior announced plans yesterday to begin a process for five-year leases to explore offshore oil and natural gas developments in the Outer Continental Shelf. The move follows the department's announced support for West Coast ocean protections earlier this week. FSRN's Christina Anastad files this report.
The Bush administration wants to increase domestic oil and gas developments along the Outer Continental Shelf with a new five-year leasing program. Department of Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne.
The Outer Continental Shelf already provides 27% of U.S. domestic oil production and 15% of domestic natural gas production, and most of that from the Gulf of Mexico. The areas under congressional ban, which may be included in this new program, contain an additional 18 billion barrels of oil, 76 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, in yet-to-be-discovered fields.
Kempthorne adds that those figures are probably conservative. Although the program is dependent on Congress lifting a ban on offshore oil drilling, the administration is moving forward regardless of if and or when that happens. The Department of Interior's offshore oil and gas leasing plan comes one day after it announced support for coastal protections with the governors of California, Oregon, and Washington. According to California's Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, the new Ocean Action Plan is aimed at supporting coastline protections and opposing offshore oil drilling. But Randall Luthy, director of the Mineral Management Service, says offshore oil drilling doesn't conflict with coastline protections.
It is not inconsistent. In fact, that's one of the main things we'll be asking for, comments from the governors on whether they think it's important or not important to have development off their shore.
Luthy adds the Mineral Management Service is also spearheading a new plan to develop alternative energy, like wave and tidal power along the Outer Continental Shelf. Meanwhile, many Democrats oppose the Bush administration's push for offshore oil drilling. California Congressmember Mike Thompson says currently, oil and gas companies are using less than 20% of the leased areas for offshore oil and gas developments.
Which would indicate that they're making a business decision that the oil resource is more valuable to them in the ground to hold on to it for later extraction when oil prices go up.
Thompson suggests legislation to regulate oil speculators to help lower the cost of gas at the pump. Beginning Friday, the Department of Interior opens a public comment period for the proposed 5-year lease program. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush issued a broad reorganization of the nation's intelligence community. While being briefed on the changes, lawmakers walked out, angry about being left in the dark. And civil liberties groups reject what they see as an erosion of privacy. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell has more.
The president signed the executive order Wednesday night, prompting outrage from members of Congress, including members of his own party. Led by top Republican on the House Intelligence Committee, Pete Hoekstra, Republicans walked out on the administration's briefing because they were not consulted on the negotiations that have been going on for more than a year. The changes are to President Reagan's Executive Order 12333. Bush is now directing the intelligence community to report to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, an office that was created in 2004 to centralize intelligence gathering. The intelligence director reports directly to the president. Democrat Jane Harman, who was just briefed on the changes, said she supports them.
What I like about this is that this change enables the DNI, who is a civilian, to be the coordinator across the government. I'm for that.
New powers given to the National Intelligence Director are largely management. The office will coordinate and direct communications between the 17 intelligence agencies and manage the intelligence budget. The CIA, which has long been the main intelligence agency, has signed off on the accord. G.I. Wilson, retired colonel in the military and intelligence operative who also did 3 tours of duty in Iraq, said this is just another layer of bureaucracy that inhibits successful intelligence gathering.
It centralizes everything at the top. It centralizes the execution at the top. It centralizes the control at the top. Now, if you're a bureaucrat and you're at the top, that's very handy. But if you're an operational type in the field and have to depend upon intelligence, that's a huge obstacle to overcome.
Under the new order, the Director of National Intelligence will also direct covert operations, while the CIA implements them. Wilson points to Iraq as an example of bureaucratic intelligence gone bad.
I think that's a pretty good example of what happens when you start managing and centralizing and keeping intelligence at the highest level, particularly when it's done by those who are in the field, done by those who are not in contact with the adversary. That's what happens when you do things in D.C., just gets into that do loop between the White House and the Pentagon and Congress and has very little to do with reality out there. I don't think anybody is pleased with the quality of intelligence that was used to kick the war off in Iraq.
In addition to concerns about poor intelligence, privacy concerns exist as well. In the first section of the executive order, the Defense Intelligence Agency is directed to collect and analyze information from defense and non-defense related agencies. Caroline Fredrickson, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, says this is prying open the possibility of collecting information on Americans.
To the extent that people provide information about themselves to any number of government agencies, from the Department of Health and Human Services to the IRS, to the Department of Labor or wherever else, they don't assume that this information is going to go into our spy master's database, but now it can.
The White House points to increased oversight by the Attorney General, which the president tasked with protecting civil liberties. Congress is expected to spend some time delving deeper into the directive, although the president has already cemented the order. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Human rights and press freedom groups are raising alarms about a secret deal struck between the International Olympic Committee and the Chinese government, allowing China to block access to certain websites. Before it was chosen as host country, China had agreed to complete media freedom. Human Rights Watch director Minky Warden says the International Olympic Committee's actions are scandalous.
It's a pretty shocking development that the International Olympic Committee has not only concealed the fact the Chinese government was not honoring its solemn pledge, but is actually abetting the Chinese government in its censorship of this vital information during the Olympics.
Warden says there's been an unprecedented crackdown on free speech and dissent leading up to next week's Olympic Games.
Many of the human rights activists, lawyers, and journalists who have carved out space to do their work in China have either been put under house arrest, forcibly hauled out of town, or have been put in prison. There has been a massive sweep of undesirables from the host city, including even recyclers. And there's been an increasing abuse of ethnic minority Tibetans and Uyghurs. I think the amazing thing is we'd actually know more about the human rights abuses that are taking place in China today if the Chinese government was upholding its pledge for media freedom.
Beijing authorities have blocked access to the websites of Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the U.S. State Department, and other sites critical of China's human rights record. But Warden says it's unknown what impact China's censorship will have on international journalists trying to file reports on stories other than sports coverage.
I think this could very well be the tip of the iceberg. There has already been some reporting about the possibility the Chinese government will pull the plug on coverage, on television coverage, live coverage from Tiananmen Square or from the Great Wall of China. And I think this incident shows that we don't even know what we don't know in relation to what concessions the International Olympic Committee has made, what other secret deals there have been, and as far as what the Chinese government has planned in terms of coverage of the Games.
Anticipating sweeping media censorship, Human Rights Watch and the Committee to Protect Journalists published a reporter's guide to covering the Olympics, including details on getting around China's so-called Great Internet Firewall. For the guide and more on media censorship during the Olympics, go to china.hrw.org. More than 6,000 print journalists have lost their jobs in recent months, part of a nationwide trend of newspaper cutbacks brought on by the steady decline of circulation, advertising revenue, and stock prices. Media watchdogs say that coverage of international as well as national news has been suffering the most, with only 4 major newspapers retaining their foreign bureaus. Some analysts are referring to the job cuts as a crisis for democracy as well as the news-gathering industry. Others have begun looking to the internet and a new era of bloggers and citizen journalists to take up the news torch. I recently spoke with Joe Torres, he's the government relations manager for Free Press, about the effects of media consolidation on the industry, how it's affected journalists, and how everyday people are getting involved in the struggle for media reform.
So there's a massive amount of consolidation happening. It's been happening for the past 20 years, but it's really accelerated at the 1996 Telecom Act that totally lifted ownership limits, for instance, in radio. Since 1996 to 2007, the end of 2007, there's actually been a reduction, 39% reduction, in the actual number of owners of individual radio stations. Television stations, networks continue to own more television stations. The cap went up on how many stations they can own. Newspapers are consolidated. More than 80% of daily newspapers are owned by a corporate chain. And that has totally changed the newsroom, because these companies take on greater debt to merge, to buy other properties. Because they take on greater debt, they lay off journalists to increase their profit margins and pay back that debt. And their profit margins are shrinking now because of the internet. They no longer, particularly newspapers in local television stations, they have competition on the local ad market from Craigslist and Google and stuff like that, these online media companies. And so they continue to cut jobs of journalists. And for journalists of color, they really don't, for the most part, understand what's happening when it comes to media and telecom policy that has resulted in layoffs. There's a greater awareness now that they're being laid off, that these companies are so bottom-line driven that they don't care about the product. But, you know, this could be an opportunity to an awakening almost to start understanding the business they're in and start challenging, fighting that back. Or if not, that they're going to continue to be almost like the sheep who go into the slaughter and totally, you know, think they're helpless to change the situation.
Do you really see that happening, though? Do you really see this being an impetus for change because it's really affecting people's livelihoods?
Well, it can. I think what may happen, what normally happens, is that it has to be a more bottom-up kind of a thing approach. It's not going to be a top-down. So I think that for change to happen, the public has to be involved. The community has to be involved, and the community has to have a greater understanding of how this system is not serving them. It's a political issue. When the community is able to challenge members of Congress, the FCC, that they want change in our media system, then I think you'll start seeing the other groups, the journalists, the national civil rights groups, getting more involved. You know, during the 1960s and 70s, it was the bottom-up. It was the folks, it was the people who were challenging media systems. Across the country, local communities were challenging the license of broadcast stations. It wasn't a national coordinated effort by civil rights groups or anything like that. I don't see the same thing happening here. It's going to be a bottom-up approach, and as the bottom-up approach, let's say, takes fire one day, you'll see the larger groups, I think, get involved when it's a little safer, I think, for them to get involved. I don't think they're going to lead it, but they have a role, though.
Joe Torres is the government relations manager at Free Press. More information on freepress.net. That's freepress.net. And now, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Of terrorist lists and listers. With the news that Nelson Mandela, former South African president, was, until scant days ago, on U.S. government terrorist watch lists, comes knowledge of how false and political such a process is. For you can bet your bottom dollar that no U.S. terrorist list ever included the names of the white Afrikaners who led the South African nationalists, who used the machinery of government to inflict terror on millions of Africans for generations. Mandela, though, as part of the black resistance movement against racism and apartheid, had his name and those of others who were members of the African National Congress added to U.S. government terrorist lists. Does this at least suggest that something other than terrorism motivated U.S. list makers? The government that shot down black school kids for protesting at Sharpeville didn't merit listing. The government that relegated the lives, hopes, and dreams of millions, the majority of its population, to half-lives of poverty, ignorance, and servitude, through brutality and violence, didn't merit such a listing. Yet those who opposed it did. What does it tell you of the list makers? When the international community, voting through the United Nations, opposed the apartheid regime, one government in the world used its votes to veto and block all actions against them, the United States of America. When young people around the world protested, the U.S., often through President Ronald Reagan and the late Jesse Helms, called for constructive engagement. The state terrorists who ran South Africa had no greater ally than the U.S. Why should it then surprise us that the opponents of that racist government were listed, until a few days ago, by the U.S. government as terrorists? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.